So hi everybody, welcome along to Wednesday night, Discovering the Path. And those of you online, I'm glad you could make it and welcome. So we'll begin as we normally do, we'll do a short meditation, we'll say some prayers together, and then the class will begin. And during the class there's spaces for questioning and also for meditation. So as we go through, if you do find something puzzling or I'm not very clear about it, please just raise your hand and question me about it. Okay, so just get comfortable in your seat. Ideally, your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. Now you can either close your eyes completely or close them so a little bit of light comes in. And let your body breathe itself. With the body relaxed and the mind concentrated, imagine that the space in front of you and above you appears Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light and he is sitting on a throne of gold. He is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and meditational deities, as well as the protectors. And imagine that you are surrounded by all sentient beings. These include your parents, close family members, friends, strangers, and difficult people. You recollect that all of us have a wish to avoid suffering, but everyone equally has a wish to be happy, yet all of us equally lack genuine happiness. Although this is our present situation, it doesn't need to stay this way, because these causes of suffering are dependent. And being dependent, they can be altered, changed, and even eliminated. So everything that causes the suffering can be abandoned, and the potential for genuine happiness can actually be accomplished. Now, to do this, we need to rely upon a teacher, teachings, and a community. These in the Buddha Dharma are called the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So think that to bring about your own welfare and be capable of helping everybody else do the same, you will rely upon the Buddha, his teachings, the Dharma, and his spiritual community called the Sangha. And to affirm this, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create to listen to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create to listen to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being above you, this includes the Buddha and the spiritual entourage, rays of light and nectar pour out of the heart of each enlightened being. And there's lots of nectar pour over yourself and all the beings surrounding you. And these lights and nectars remove obstacles to your practice and they empower your present potentials of method and wisdom. So you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts, these being love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and then to establish all beings of those four immeasurable states. To affirm this, you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. They rain down upon yourself and all sentient beings. And these four qualities now effortlessly manifest. And you recollect the field of merit and prepare yourself to purify the mind, to accumulate the merit, and then to increase merit. So the Buddha and his companions now appear as this field of merit. And you say, Reverend Buddha, I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. Now, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the practices that we've just accomplished, we need to imagine that our own body and every object of our senses is utterly transformed to reappear as a pure Buddha land. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents of southern moon. I imagine this is the Buddha field and offered. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So may this offering, and the Buddha accepts it, and he smiles at us, and we look up into his smiling eyes. And when we meet the gaze of the Buddha, we feel accepted, and as if every wish we have will be met. Now, an emanation of the Buddha leaves the heart of the Buddha, moves through space, comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Then this emanation begins to descend, entering the crown of your head and coming down to the level of your heart. And at the level of your heart, the emanation expands. It fills your body and mind with light and nectars. And these pour out through the pores of your skin. They begin to fill the 10 directions of space. The light and nectar establishes every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And it's from within this enlightened state that we hear the resound echo of the mantra of the Buddha. And hearing it, we join in reciting it three times, and then we recite it a number of times under the breath. Jataya Om Ri Mahamunaya Soha. Taya Om Ri Mahamunaya Soha. Taya Om Ri Mahamunaya Soha. I had to all Mahamune I think that you have accomplished everything you need for yourself and also accomplished the welfare of all beings. Now these lights withdraw from the 10 directions of space and they re-enter your heart. You can feel the hardness of the seat beneath you and hear the sounds of traffic passing by. You find yourself embodied once again. And you reaffirm this wish to become fully awakened, meaning you wish to develop your wisdom and your compassion and every other skill you possess to bring about the welfare of all living beings. I think that to do that, we need to accomplish the path to that enlightenment. And that's why we're here this evening to find out more about how to do that. And then we breathe in through the nostrils, exhale through the mouth, and let your eyes flutter open now. And move your body, your shoulders, your hands and arms. Just become comfortable in the seat. Okay, so this is class 7 of an 8-unit presentation. So we've covered a bit of material. We began by looking at Buddhist history. So in that class, we looked at how Buddha Dharma was developed in India and spread out to all the different countries of the world. And then we looked at what's called the 12 deeds of the Buddha. And it was, it seems to be like maybe it's like a history, but it's not. It's a hagiography. Meaning it's a sort of a teaching aid, a spiritual teaching aid. And then we looked, of course, at the three wrong ways to listen and the six correct ways to listen. As well as that, we introduced the foundation of all good qualities and showed you the outline of the 14 verses. And we've been going through it week by week, and we began by looking at the practices of those of small and middling capacity. And last week, we looked at the development of wishing bodhicitta for those of great capacity. So we're continuing on about these practices for those of great capacity to create a mind that wishes to become enlightened. Can you remember the two major practices that we're doing to do that? Yes.
Seven fold cause and effect.
That's right. Sevenfold cause and effect, and there's also equalizing, exchanging self for other. So we've got these two practices, and what's often said is you study them one at a time, but when you actually go to practice, you put them both together, and you sort of have about 11 or 12 points to go through. Now today we're going to have a look at the three principal aspects of the path. Show you how they relate to these three motivational steps called your personal small capacity, middling capacity, and great capacity. We'll have a little look at what bodhicitta is. Now, to create this course or tonight's teaching, I sort of relied upon these books and others as well. There's a couple, I mean, they're all really good. But if you really want to look for getting the really details of this. Practices for persons of great capacity. There's this book down the bottom here called Courageous Compassion, and the other one right up in the corner, at the top corner of the left, I think, it's called In Praise of Great Compassion. These two books by His Holiness and Venerable Thupten Jodrön are really excellent. They cover the whole width of the practice and also the depth. So basically today, like I said, we're going to talk about these practices of engagement, and we'll look at verse 8. So we begin by looking at, we're going to look at equanimity first, then have a look at this self-cherishing. What is it? And how can we work against it using the Tonglen practice? The Tonglen is also called giving and taking. So we have those, and then finally we'll look at the perfections. So quite a bit of work here to look at tonight, at least four major subjects. So if you look at equanimity first, Ben, you know, can you recollect what equanimity is or what its function is? Excellent. That's good, Ben. Chris, any idea? Did you go on with that? Okay. We're trying to develop what they call an unbiased mental state, a state where it's impartial.
That it
What is
was
impart? What is
to
equanimity?
equalize our attitude.
Towards friends, enemies, and strangers. Yeah.
Okay.
In other words, trying to develop an unbiased mental state called impartiality. It's another way, another term for it. And often they start off with this by looking at people like a cherished friend, somebody who's really difficult, and someone who's like a random stranger. And we notice like how we feel towards these three different people. And you'll find that you have a lot of affection for the dear friend and to the difficult person, you most often have aversion, and the strangers, you don't really care about them. So you're sort of indifferent. So these are three different mental states. And what we've got to try and do is like what they call like equalize them. So they're not so different. So the question that arises like, why should we do that? What's the purpose of being impartial towards all beings? In short, it's like if we don't bring about the state of impartiality first, we can't develop like an impartial loving kindness or concern for others. Because we'll just have that towards our friends, but not towards the strangers or the difficult people. And it's the same thing with compassion. We'll only find that we've got compassion for our nearest and dearest, but the strangers, we won't even be concerned with them. And the difficult people, we might even think, well, good job. So we're not going to go very far. I mean, this is how we are right now, isn't it? So we're not going to develop very much if we keep these sort of ideas. So we need to lower them, sort of say, or get on like a level playing field. Yeah, so basically we need like a level playing field to develop compassion, which is analytically, meaning through thinking and reasoning, we recognize that our labels of friend or enemy are fragile and constantly shift over time. Just as a host at a banquet provides the same quality of food to every guest, regardless of their status, an even-minded person offers the same basic respect to every living being. And this function of the mind removes the friction of attachment and the heat of anger, allowing us to see that everyone has a shared wish for. Equanimity is practiced differently as you make progress on the stages of the path. So it begins what we call like a form of small scope. So when we begin practice, we just have this wish that all beings overcome their afflictions towards one another. So you might say, how wonderful it would be if all beings could abide in equanimity, like we just said a minute ago, right? Free of the bias of attachment to some and anger to others. May they come to abide that way. I'll help them. And please, all you enlightened beings have done it, help me do this. So we're just wishing. We're not actually going to do anything about it. What we want, we would like everybody to have an equanimous mind, right? Because we know what it's like to be in the face of anger. We know that ourselves, we have attachments to different objects, how the mind really changes. So here we're not really doing much, but just wishing. We can see, oh, there's a lot of benefit if we could just have a mind that was equanimous. I wish I could have such a mind. I wish others could have such a mind. So that's the beginning. You'll see this again and again of how developing these states begins with a wish. Like you have to want it. That when we want it, then you find, oh, this is how you get it. You find the means to develop such a mind. So at the small scale, I say, as beginners, if you look at yourself as a beginner, this is how you start. I wish everybody could have a mind that was autonomous, unbiased. Then as you make progress and you see that actually it's not such a good idea to stay in samsara, to stay confused. So I've got to do something about that. So that's where we come to the next one called the middle scope, and it says, here we decide to overcome our own attachment and anger towards friends, enemies, and strangers. But so here we go. Now, okay, now I have to remove anger from my own mind. I have to remove attachment. I have to remove this indifference or not caring about others. And then it's like, okay, now, yeah, okay, now we have to. We actually have to work, right? We have to go beyond the wish. We go, I have to do this. If I don't do this, I cannot free myself from cyclic existence. My mind will remain confused, and so will my behaviors. So we're really looking, working on ourselves here. Then we come to the great scope, which our focus is on tonight. We have this different way. We overcome favoritism. We're directing love and compassion towards others. And this, at this place here, we have this, the first one, middle scope, we want to free ourselves. In the next one, we still keep that wish, but now we want to help others free themselves of this impartial and biased mind. So, partial and biased mind. Now, there's also, when you study these paths, as Ben pointed out at the beginning, there is this way of developing equanimity or impartiality between friends, enemies, and strangers. And that like levels the playing field. It's like we're getting your mind already to now start building love and compassion on it once it's leveled. And so this is what they call equanimity. And we develop this equanimity between friends, enemies, and strangers. And this equanimity is the one that's developed in what they call the six causes and one effect, which is, you know, one of the ways of developing the wishing bodhicitta. If you really wish to have this mind that wants to put an end to everybody's suffering and knows that the only way I can do that is to become a Buddha, you go through this particular way of developing the mind of enlightenment, this is you start here. And level the ground between friends, enemies, and strangers. However, there's another practice, as we know, called equalizing self and equalizing, exchanging self for others. And in there, they also have a practice of equanimity, but it's a little different. And there they call it equalizing self with other. And as you can see, it's just what it does between ourselves and other beings. So just to go through these two, we're trying to show you some difference between them. The meditation to equalize self and others differs from the equanimity meditation of between friends, enemies, and strangers. Well, the first one, leveling the ground between friends, enemies, and strangers, this overcomes the emotional reactions of attachment and animosity with respect to friends and enemies. That steers us toward an unbiased openness for these two groups of people. But the meditation on equalizing self and others overcomes something much deeper. Our tendency to consider ourselves more valuable and important than other sentient beings. So this meditation brings a deep conviction that we and others are fundamentally equal in wanting happiness and freedom from suffering. And again, this is a summit, whereas equanimity levels the playing ground of friends, enemies, and strangers. Equalizing self and others levels it between us and others. Is that difference sort of noticeable to you? Can you understand what I'm sort of saying? My friends, enemies, and strangers, we look at them, we see how their labels change all the time. We know that friends can become enemies, they can become strangers, strangers can become friends. So you sort of do that analysis, you go, my gosh, it's, gee, there's nothing stable there at all. I can't, why can I hang on to some and not the other? It changes. Right? We're looking at them, but then when we come to the other, now we're looking at ourselves and others. We say, ah, there's no difference between me and you. You want to be happy, I do too. We're the same. Oh, I see that you're suffering and I suffer too. We're the same, we're equal. Right? I see that we wish to be free, but we're not. We're the same. Now, before we come to the meditation, are there any questions you'd like to ask? So just Here we just look at equanimity, and there's two different types. So let's do our first meditation. Again, you just need to check your posture. You want to have your back straight, the shoulders relaxed. Place your hands wherever they feel comfortable. And now you can close your eyes or keep them partially open. And just let your body breathe itself. It does this every night when you fall asleep, and it's been doing it all day as you've been walking around. You're just letting the body and the mind settle. Now imagine you have one of your close friends in front of you, a stranger, and someone who doesn't like you or that you feel anxious around. Do you notice a pull towards your friend, like a push away from the difficult person, and sort of indifference towards the stranger? There's sort of a push and pull going on between like and dislike. Now just imagine your mind is no longer worn out by the push and pull of like and dislike, and generating altruistic intention to help all beings. And recollect that our roles with each other always shift and change. And recollect that your personal needs are not more urgent than those of others. In fact, our need for happiness and freedom from suffering are the same as others. And when we forget this, then aversion and anger tends to grow. But when we hold our equality with one another in mind, then the sort of rough edges of self-focus begin to sort of smooth out. So imagine a person who treats all those they meet as they would a dear and lost child. So what might change for us if we stop sorting people into these two categories of helpful person and unhelpful person? Yeah, what might change for us if we stop sorting people into friends and enemies? People likable, unlikable. If this could be stopped, you might find that you sort of rest in a quiet, peaceful state that is firm, no matter how others act or what they say. But can you imagine yourself to be like a host at a feast who serves each guest with the same care, no matter who they are? So how might this clear and steady mind, this equanimous mind, how might it be different from sort of cold distance or not caring at all? Well, it's not caring. It shuts the heart down. It shuts the caring and concern down. But the balanced state, the mind of equanimity, opens it wide. It's calm and being in a fully present mind. What does the ground need to look like before deep care for others can truly take root? Well, it needs to be level. We need a state of mind that sees each being with the same basic worth and respect. When we clear away bias, we can truly care for everyone, not just those we prefer. So see if you can just carry this idea through the rest of the evening and into tomorrow. Treating each person you meet just like you. Recollecting that this person, just like you, wants nothing more than to be happy. And breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And this is your last flush right in blue of your bottom. And now we're going to go into a little section about bodhicitta and this mind that works against it, often called self-cherishing. So bodhicitta, first of all, is for the sake of others, wishing to attain complete, perfect enlightenment. You remember last week we had a much longer definition for it? So bodhicitta is also the entryway into the Mahayana path. If you can develop this mind, you are what they call, well, they call your bodhisattva, a Mahayana Buddhist. And bodhicitta here, you can see it's made up of two parts. One is called bodhi and the other is called citta. So citta means mind or thought or attitude. And bodhi means awake or enlightenment or awakening. Like I said, you develop this first into you develop in stages. First, you wish to have such a mind. And once the wish is firm, you're okay, now I actually want to, now I've got this mind, I need to do something with it. In this school, we engage in the practices of the bodhisattva, which are the perfections. So we'll talk about all that as we keep going. Now, there is an attitude that really stops this mind. Well, there's two, actually. The first one is anger. If you're angry, you can't have this mind. Anger just shuts this mind down. They work against each other. But there's a, like if we ask what creates the anger, then we have a number of different answers. So sometimes it's said to be like self-grasping ignorance, or they call self-cherishing. So self-cherishing and self-grasping are two different types of mind, but they're interrelated, highly, well, they support one another. It's also given the name self-centeredness, or what's it called? Egocentricity. Egocentricity, self-centeredness, self-cherishing, all words that mean the same sort of thing. So what I've put here is this hand, and this hand is sort self-cherishing, or this self-centeredness, is like a person who's holding on to a really hot coal. They want to be warm, but all it does is they get warmer, right? It burns them, right? And so as much as they'd like to be pleasantly warm, it actually hurts them. This is the sort of mind where you think it's on your side, but it actually works against you. It makes us, well, this type of mind goes, I'm more important than you. All my concerns are much more important than yours. But then we can ask ourselves, like, is this type of mind, is it an affliction? Is it an obscuration? So, you know, as you know in Buddha Dharma, we talk about things that we need to get rid of through the path. And these are often called afflictive obscurations or cognitive obscurations. So the question to be asked is self-cherishing either of these? And the answer is no. It's none of them. Yeah, it's really strange, right? So this is where these two books I talked about, this is where it's really good to read this. Yeah, it's...
What is it then?
Well, here we go. I think I'll put it up here. It's called an inferior obscuration, which is a hindrance for the bodhisattvas to abandon. So, you know, the people who want to achieve their own personal liberation, they don't need to do this. It's only for those who want to help everybody and become a Buddha. They need to get rid of this. This is a hindrance for them. It's not a hindrance for the other people. So what they're sort of saying here is there are different types of self-centeredness. And there is one that we're all familiar with, and this is the major one. They call it gross self-centeredness, or a really obvious self-cherishing. And this is harmful for everyone, anyone, whether you're a spiritual practitioner or not. It's that although the self-centered attitude is called an obscuration, it's not an actual obscuration, because it's not the object of abandonment of a path. But it is a hindrance for the bodhisattvas. So if we wish to free ourselves of all beings from suffering or become a Buddha, it's a problem for us then, if that's the thing we need to do. Now, the emptiness does that, but it's a problem in the fact that, like I said, that wish provides the energy, isn't it? Yeah, so again, like if you don't have this wish, well, we're not going to get rid of the cognitive obscurations. Yeah. But it's actually wisdom to realize the emptiness it doesn't, but it does need this attitude, you know, for some. You know, perhaps in some time in the past, you might have heard of people, like, yeah, people do things for themselves. There's many people do. But there are many others who also do things not just for themselves, but for everybody else. You know, like a doctor, for instance. You might know yourself, well, yeah, I want to become a doctor. You're like, why? It's good money. So why am I doing it? Good money. It's for me. But you might have another guy who comes along and goes, well, you know, I had a child myself, but all the suffering they went through really had this huge impact on me. I love that child. So I want to help my child, but I also want to help all children that are just like my own. So that's a different. You know, and so the energy of just working for yourself and for your own money is very different than if you're working for all children.
So then does it come down to the intention?
Yeah, always.
No matter, like, it could apply to anything.
Yep, that's right.
Maybe.
Yeah, well, this is why Lama's life has spent so much time always on the intention. Because the intention, from a Buddhist perspective, is the karma. Right? So you can create, with the intention, you create the karma to bring about your own welfare or the welfare of all beings. And so they always say, like, go for this bodhicitta attitude. But it's real big. You'll accomplish everything you want anyway. Because the self-centered attitude is a habitual focus on personal desires above the collective welfare. Like I say, you always look at, like, what's me rather than us. This orientation functions as the primary cause for internal pain. By magnifying our own importance, we become vulnerable to every minor external problem. It resembles a person desperately clutching a hot coal, hoping to stay warm, not only burning their own hands. So you transform the narrow habit of just looking after yourself by cultivating this sort of universal perspective that cherishes every living being equally. That's why you find in the six causes and one effect, you start off with the equanimity of friends, enemy, stranger, which is not even included as part of the practice. It's just a preliminary. But then you sort of look at all sentient beings have been my mother. And so then straight off, you've got this huge perspective, isn't it? It's not like I've just one mother in one life. So mothers, I've had mothers countless lives. Each of them have been kind to me. I need to repay that kindness. You know? What's the best way I can repay that kindness? Self-centeredness has a different, has a number of, I'd say, there's different types of it, and there's different levels of it. Meaning you can have some that's really obvious and some that's definitely not obvious, you know, sort of hidden from you. But this, so coarse, or meaning obvious self-centeredness, obvious... Yeah, it's the same word for self-cherishing, Georgia. I just I like this other one too. Ego.
Oh,
egocentricity. Yeah. So this egocentricity, like, find out for yourself, as I did in my life, it hurts you. Right? You get to all sorts of problems once you're like this. And in fact, I always thought, well, isn't everybody this way? Isn't everybody self-centered? They're not. But I'm hanging out with a lot of people who were, so I thought everybody was. So what types of harms does self-centeredness create? So there are many of them, but I just put some of these ones here, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama put down. So first of all, you all sorts of unhealthy fears. Low self-esteem. Anxiety, guilt, and rage. So self-cherishable, this is what they call self-centeredness, is behind all of these other emotions. And this is really easy to check. Just what's happening when you get angry. You know, like what's going on here? It's like, no, you know, you're saying you are more important than the people you're angry towards. That's sort of really like obvious thing. So here's a little bit what His Holiness says in from the book In Praise of Great Compassion. It is all people recognize our coarse self-centeredness as harmful. So self-centeredness believes that our happiness and suffering are more important than that of others, that what we want to happen should happen, and that our opinions are right, and that our ideas are the best. This is a self-preoccupation that we see in children, and that as adults we learn to hide under the pretense of gentility, although it's still present.
Manners.
That's right, manners. Yes. Just, the coarse, self-centered attitude lies behind the creation of all destructive karma, meaning all destructive actions. It is involved with low self-esteem, guilt, rage, jealousy, greed, anxiety, and unhealthy fear. Self-centeredness chases others away, and then we feel sorry for ourselves because we lack friends. This coarse self-centeredness supports afflictive minds and actions, and it harms living beings, whether they are spiritual practitioners or not. For that reason, it is the practice of love and kindness and compassion in daily life is essential for working against this. This comes from that book In Praise of Great Compassion by His Holiness. In 37 Practices for Bodhisattvas, there's a great section on all the different harms that this type of mind does to you. Well, yes, I want to mention something else too. So, you know, often when people have these unhealthy fears, you know, they go through all of this stuff, we sort of focus on them rather than what's driving them crazy. So the big thing always is to identify different mental states, because they're the cause behind the person's acting badly. And they sort of say, you know, they give an example in Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva, which is, you know, when somebody has a stick and they hit you, who do you get angry at? Or what do you get angry at? Yeah, we get angry at the person, don't they? But what hurts you?
Stick.
The stick. Right? So if we're going to look at the person and blame the person for hitting us, because they're holding the stick, right? The stick can't hurt us on its own. It's been wielded by the person. They hold the stick and they use it, we're hurt, right? She says, well, persons, they're in the grip of anger. But if we're going to blame the person who blamed us, you know, the stick example, then we should look behind the person, look what's holding the person. It's mind, self-centeredness. They're in the grip of self-centeredness. And you find that when people are angry, oh, they're in the grip of anger, right? When they come out, don't they often say, I'm so sorry? Like, you know, I didn't mean that. Or, you know?
I don't know what came over me.
Yeah, I don't know what came over me. That's right, we say these things, aren't we? That's right. But what came over you was the mind of anger. So when we look for something to blame, try not to, you know, blame the person.
Eddie, low esteem is an interesting one in there. How does, because low esteem, holding, or low, is it, am I reading it right that it's low self-esteem?
Yeah.
Holding yourself less than others is still self-centeredness.
Yep, that's right.
Can you?
Yeah.
Well, expand on that a bit, please.
Well, your object of focus is you. And you feel like you're, well, all this funny garbage, not much, these sort of things. So your object of focus is you, and you've underestimated what you're actually capable of doing. This one is a big thing here, looking at what we call Buddha nature. So you've forgotten you have the same potential as the Buddha had to become fully awakened. Don't you know that? And people go, no. Or we forget, huh? We forget. Because these types of emotions are much more powerful from where we are than the reasoning, than what we can remember. You know, even if you say, I've got Buddha nature. Well, guess what? It's not going to stop you getting angry. And people with Buddha nature get angry, don't they? That's what happens. But if you can remember that you've got it, it might give you this pause to go, oh, no, hang on a minute. I know I have all the faults of anger. I know what happens after that. It's terrible. But so I can sort of go, I'm not that low. But I have actually something to offer here. The other great thing to work against low self-esteem is fortune, human rebirth. You know, wow, like, you know, all these people born human, but guess what? Out of all of them, I have the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments. There's no reason at all for me to have low self-esteem. If anyone's got them, it's all the people that don't have what I've got. Fortune, human rebirth, and Buddha nature are the things to remind yourself of when you feel like you're worthless. Now, self-centeredness, self-cherishing, and egocentricity, it creates all sorts of mental states that will harm you and have you harm others. It's sort of what it does. What can we do instead of, once we sort of know this, and we do behave, imagine that somebody attacks you in some way. Yeah, usually verbally, people criticize us or say unkind things like this, right? And we're hurt by it. What are we going to do? What can we do? There's lots of things we can do. But in this, where we are at this stage of the path in terms of practice, there's a practice called Tonglen, or giving and taking. That's really the main sort of practice here. And its real function, its deepest function, is to create in ourselves courage to face suffering. And so if you have this courage, then you can start using suffering on the path, taking it onto the path and developing, in our case, compassion and kindness. The pension, Lhasa Chetty Gelson says, therefore, O venerable, compassionate gurus, bless me that all karmic obscurations and sufferings of mother migrators ripen upon me right now, and that I may give others my happiness and virtuous deeds, in order that all sentient beings may have happiness. This is what His Holiness says about this, and this is taken from the book, The Union of Bliss and Emptiness. He says, if such a visualization is done, it harms the self-cherishing attitude because it brings about the experience of a threat to the sense of permanence and independence normally associated with our feeling of I. Again, he says, we naturally guard our own comfort while keeping others' hardships at a distance. This verse represents the peak of mental training, where we intentionally reverse this habit to develop a courageous, altruistic heart. It challenges the idea that we are separate from the world around us. This mental exercise, often called taking and giving, involves a radical exchange. We mentally accept the negative patterns and pain of all beings who've been kind to us, as our very own parents, using their sufferings as a tool to destroy our self-centeredness. We simultaneously give away our joy and positive energy. Now, this is not about becoming a victim. It's a therapeutic method to dissolve the solidity of the ego, which keeps us lonely and fearful. Now, so I remember many years ago, and a long time ago now, when Miffy's mother was alive, and she gave me a text on how to do this practice. She gave me this text and another young woman. And on it, she had to got one of those stickies and stuck on the thing. She warned us to make sure you aim at the right target. Because it says here, take all sufferings upon yourself. So if you take that literally, you're going to get in trouble straight away. So you have to sort of know, what are you talking about self? What is the self here that you're talking about? The self has different meanings. So this is why it's important to know what meaning of self is applicable here. So, yeah, as you'll see, I'll keep going and we'll have a look. So what is Tonglen? It's a mental training designed to reverse our habitual self-centeredness. So like I said before, everything is about us. Right? We're focused on self, me. To reverse that, we focus on others. We focus on you. And we think, the same things that I really want for myself, I know you want too. Like to be free of suffering and happy. So to tackle my own sort of indifference towards you and self-cherishing, I'll make my object of focus your suffering, your concerns, and I'll work with them to work against my own indifference. Now, this is a bit like at the moment, we know there's troubles all over the world. You see it on TV and people getting killed and all this sort of thing. A lot of harm has been created. So a lot of people don't want to see that. And in fact, they sort of, even if they see it, they're indifferent to it. It's like, it's not happening to me, it's not to my kids. It's like, yeah, it's terrible, but that's just how it is. And so, that's as far as our concern goes. It's no more than that. So this sort of training reverses that, changes that completely. So like I said, what you really do here is developing courage, because it's not easy to face suffering, your own or anybody else's. And of course, before you do this practice, way back in the practices of the middle scope, we had to find our own sufferings and our own causes, right? To look at those first. So we know actually this is my situation. You go, oh my gosh, my situation is no different than the situation of everybody else. None of us have control over the external world and what's going on inside us. And we're all in the same boat, so to speak. So what's the great thing about just focusing on me? We're all the same. So just thinking, okay, now I'm going to focus on others now. And just as much as I want to be happy, I'll do whatever it takes for them to be happy. And all of this is done in imagination. Like I said, the most important thing when you do this is identify the object that you're going to place all the suffering on. It's called self, but what self? I'll show you what we're doing in the taking and the giving, and then explain to you what the self is that we're concerned with here. So Tom then, the practice of taking. So how to meditate on it? Because if you're unsure, then the suggestion is start with yourself. If you think it's going to be too hard to think to imagine taking the suffering off every other being, imagine taking it off your future self. So you know, so we're all, I don't know, all different ages here, but we all know that as people get older, they get sick, right? And they experience different types of suffering, and so we're no different. So if you can imagine, say, 10 to 15 years time, and say, so imagine I get cancer, which lots of people do. You want to do something about that, don't you? We will, don't we? We're probably not just going to sit there and go, oh, so I got cancer. You guess what? And just leave it like that and just let the thing run rampant, right? So now you want to get rid of it, wouldn't you? You go, yeah. And so what we normally do is like we go to the doctors and we take all the treatments and so forth. So here we don't do that. We just imagine that 15 years in the future, we have cancer, and we do this imaginary. So we're sitting here now, we're Buddhist practitioners, we know what to do. Here's my future self, got cancer. What am I want to do? I want to get it off him. Okay, well, just take it off him imaginatively. Imagine each time you breathe in, you take off the present cancers that they're experiencing and their causes, and you bring them into here. And because you're no longer indifferent, right, it comes into you, bring it into your heart. It smashes your indifference towards your future. And instead, your love and concern goes out in the bright white light and heals yourself. That's basically what you're doing. No matter what the suffering is, you're taking it. If and its causes imaginary coming into your heart, which has often been indifferent to yourself. But, you know, you get cancer, you'll start caring about yourself, I'm sure. Right? And you go, okay. Now, smash the indifference, the actual concern has been released. It goes back towards my future self and gives me all the healing that I need. So we get sort of comfortable doing that with ourselves. Yeah, I have it, it's easy. Okay, we'll start now. Take your brother, take your sister, take your mother, take the people close to you. And then you start expanding as we go through here. So you begin with yourself. And you start with your future self. However, I've done it with my past self, and it works just as well. You can look back at the past selves you're suffering. For me as a kid, you know what you needed. And you go, here I am now, I'll give you what you need. Man, it changed my life. So you can do that in the past as well. But when you do the future, you do the effects of suffering, like all the cancers, the sicknesses, whatever. Also the causes. If you don't take away the causes, you're going to get sick again, aren't you? So you need to take away the actual effect, its causes, but also the imprints that it leaves on the mind. So we're looking at different degrees of the suffering. Very gross and obvious, a little more subtle, we know the causes, and then something else underneath that leaves the stain on the mind, so we always see ourselves being separate from everybody else. So, like I said, so that I did it like on the past as well, and it works. So then once you come through with that, now you can start doing it for others. And with others, you do it with your friends. You start with your friends because it's easy. You're like your friends, right? So you don't want them to suffer, so you'll do it easier. Then you do strangers. because that's the second level of ease. You want to be there before you start with enemies, because most of us have this unwillingness to help what we call an enemy. And then you do it for everyone. And with everyone, that means the Aryans who have attained liberation, but they're not Buddhas. So they still have this sort of self-concern. They're only being concerned about themselves. And they're going to go, man, I wish you could help others. So yeah, we take away that obscuration imaginatively. But then animals, insects, like every sort of being that you can experience suffering. So what's really interesting about this, I've found, is that you know, once you get used to the process, it's quite easy. And so you might think, oh, yeah, this is like really easy. So then what I've found is like, well, find the things that you actually don't like. So one of the things that I really don't like are cockroaches. I don't like little crawly things, you know, that crawl up your nose and in your ears. Yes, right. Like that. So I get like this, right? And so I'm like, I don't want to help them. Right? Ah, there's the problem. So now when you're breathing, imagine breathing in all the cockroaches. Yeah, right. That's right. You go, oh, no, no. So we're not very brave in the face of even imagining it. That's what it doesn't end. You find yourself, you can face any type of suffering because you're not afraid. Because you've been practicing in here or in your bedroom. But again, what's really important here is what you put it on, like when you breathe it in, like where's it going? You know, we say, on.
Is it like exposure therapy?
Yeah.
Like exposing yourself gradually to something.
It's really unlikable. That's right, and getting past it.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And you do it all like in your imagination.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the taking part. When it comes to the giving, we start with oneself again, future. So here we're looking at contaminated happiness and, of course, uncontaminated happiness. So the contaminated happiness is the ordinary happiness we feel every day, without being on a path or anything, without renunciation, bodhicitta, whatever. It's the happiness contaminated with self-grasping. It's still happiness. We still need it. It's a real, if we don't have that, we don't have a base to work on. So I wonder, like, call ourselves ordinary, you know, I'm sort of happy. That's enough. Uncontaminated happiness, that's the happiness. Now it's conjoined with bodhicitta and wisdom. So that's a different kind of happiness, and that's what we're really trying to come around to creating ourselves. So we give that to ourselves. And like I said, if we did it with ourselves, if we had, we thought, wow, my mum died of cancer, for instance, perhaps I will too, then imagine you have cancer in the future and you can take it off yourself and think, well, so what do you need? What would you be like if you didn't have cancer? You know, so you're trying to imagine it as clearly as you possibly can, really helps you 15 years or 10 years or whatever, and then you start giving it. Okay. So others, friends, strangers, enemies, everyone. And here you can give your happiness to the guru, to your teacher, to all the Buddhas, to all the bodhisattvas, the enlightened beings. They don't need it. So what do you think's the idea behind all this giving?
To let go.
Yeah, to let go of clinging. Because you don't want to be clinging when you die. That's for sure. You want to just go. So the objects we cling to, of course, is usually our body. That's why you're trying to imagine your body in the going through all sorts of terrible things. I just want to see something here. Oh, man, I'm sorry. I just want to check this.
Yes.
Seems to have jumped ahead or something. I lost a couple of slides. So in this practice, they say, take all sufferings and put them on yourself.
Cherishing.
Yeah, that's the thing to remember, self-cherishing. It doesn't say self-cherishing in the text. It says on yourself. So if you follow literally, which I thought it was, the first time I did this, I could only do it once. I was like, I just thought, too much. I just, my eyes just flew up. I was like nearly choking. Like my imagination was so strong, right? And I put it on me. And that's not what you put it on. I thought about it later. Why would you want to hurt yourself? Doesn't make sense. Yeah? And it's true, it does make sense because that's not what you're doing. You're putting it on this attitude. Okay, so yeah, so with this practice, it says gather all blames and put them all onto the one. You know, which says that, but there's also a lot of place it on self. So of course, this is not, you don't put it on your conventional self, on oneself. What the self is the self-cherishing mind. What they're saying is, look, self-cherishing created all these problems. So why don't you just take all these problems and give it back to it? And I said, the most important thing is remember, it's just imagination. But this imagination can, using imagination in this way, can make, give you a lot of courage to face suffering when it actually takes place. Because there's really no difference, really. In fact, I remember this great thing. This guy said, you know, your nervous system doesn't know what's true or false. It will act as if everything is true. So if you imagine doing this and find you can do it, when it actually happens, you can do it. Let's do our meditation. Okay. Again, just adjust your body. Make sure your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed. Try to let go of any tight spots in your shoulders or jaw. Let your body breathe itself. Then altruistically choose to turn your own pain into care and kindness for all beings around you. So first of all, imagine yourself breathing in the difficulties and injustices of this world. And then breathing out a soft, healing sense of ease. You might picture what's going on in Palestine, Iraq, Rwanda, gosh, there's so many places where there are problems. But you breathe it in, either you can breathe it in through your nostrils or just breathe it straight into your heart. On the exhalation of breath, you breathe out the white light. It's all healing. This practice is called Tong Len. It's the brave act of taking in others' pain and giving back your own sense of peace in return. And when we do this, our habit of putting ourselves first begins to loosen. And the shift might feel like a window thrown open in a stuffy room. You know, the fresh air just rushes in at once. So how can you take in pain without being pulled down by its weight? Just breathe it in with an open heart. Let the hurt come in slowly as you inhale without pushing it away. Like a sponge, just sort of taking in water. And once that darkness reaches the center of your heart, it turns into warm, bright care for others. This sort of shift is like when a dark cloud breaks apart and you see the light of the sun shine through. So you breathe in the darkness of all the problems, see all problems as darkness, you breathe it in, comes into your heart, and the exhalation of breath, you breathe out light. So the darkness represents all the bad stuff, terrible stuff, causes of suffering and suffering. And the light is like the path of a true cessation. To bring relief. And the last next time you exhale, just breathe out a little longer and then just lift your eyes open and bring your attention back to the room. So this practice is what was called like a secret practice. It was done, was only given to what they said, the smartest of all the practitioners, and they had to be brave to do something like this too. What made it to be like we can just talk about it like this is because one of the great lamas taught it to the lepers. You know, so in Tibet there was a lot of leprosy. And what happened was they started to get cured. And it was because of that, it was like, okay, we've got to share this with everyone. And even today, people do this practice, have healed themselves of HIV, different illnesses, things like that. It really depends upon your sincerity in doing it, how well you do it. So I read a story of a young man who was dying of AIDS. He got given this practice. He practiced, and in a really short time, all the symptoms of AIDS fell away and he became cured, right? New Age whole lovers, like, just got to love his life, of course. He went, I've got to meet this person, find out what the heck happened. And he asked him, how long have you been doing the practice? He said, oh, just a couple of times. He said, well, this is something. You must be very sincere to bring about this type of effect. So it doesn't always work this way, like this, but it has done at different times. So, and like I said, the major thing is to develop courage. Like I said, a lot of people don't like suffering. They can't even bear to be around their own children or parents or brothers and sisters dying. It's like too much. This gets you ready to handle all of that. So we come to our verse 8. So here, Lamasongkhapa says, by clearly recognizing that developing bodhicitta without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. Please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. So we use the Tonglin practice to develop this mind of enlightenment. This is part of the wishing practices. Then we go, well, it's just all imagination. So what about really helping people? So yeah, okay, you engage in the practices of the perfections. And you do that by taking this vow. So you take the bodhisattva vow, and then you go, okay, now engage in the practices that this vow supports. And you see here it says, without practicing the three types of morality. Now, in general, we often talk about six perfections, but in fact there are 10 of them. And each perfection is made up, it can be divided up in different ways. So the perfection of morality has three types. The perfection of generosity is three. Perfection of patience is three. So each perfection, you can divide it up into three different levels.
Then you get 18.
That's right, you get a lot of eight.
Oh, I thought you said there were 10.
10 perfections, that's right.
It's six.
Six is more
broken
most common.
Into three. It's right. 18.
18, and you can take 10 and break them into three. And you've got... So the first perfection, the first four perfections are generosity is the first. And I'll just, so generosity, the perfection of generosity is the intention to give everything. It's an antidote to miserliness, and it provides the resources to stop poverty. So, you know, we're going to finish up this life and we'll die. If we've practiced well, we'll take another human rebirth. If we're not liberated or enlightened, we'll find ourselves here again. And we're going to need resources. We're going to need like a vehicle to get to centers. We want to have jobs, we want to have clothing, food, all these things. Practicing generosity now, that's the cause for that later. The perfection of ethics or morality, this is the intention to give up harming others. It's an antidote to lower realm rebirth, and it provides the higher realm rebirth. The perfection of patience means being calm and undisturbed when suffering arises. It's an antidote to anger. It stops the destruction of the roots of virtue. So whenever we create a skillful, virtuous act, once that act is finished, it can be destroyed. And the thing that destroys it is anger. So you might find this yourself if you look back over your life. You might have a strong relationship with somebody and you like them a lot, a lot of good feeling. And then something happens and you become really angry with them. All that good feeling is gone, eh? You find you can't call upon it anymore. It's really difficult. That's what anger does. So this is what anger is, a terrible opponent to the mind of enlightenment. And when we are patient, you find this is one of the great things. When you look at people that look good, you can say it's not just their biology or their DNA, it's the practice of patience. Because they've been patient in the past, now they have this wonderful look. So if you want to look good, anyway, so. And there we have joyous perseverance. So here, this is the delight in virtuous actions. It's an antidote to jealousy. And it helps you complete virtuous projects, which makes good sense, doesn't it? Now, then we have these two questions. I want us to have a look at one of these perfections in a bit of detail. And they chose the perfection of patience. So patience is, or the perfection of patience, is the ability to remain resolute and calm in the face of hardship or suffering. And I said, each of these perfections has got three sort of different levels or categories or types. Here, three types of patience. So the first one is like a stroke. So when others hurt you or harm you, you disregard it. You don't get upset and fire up and everything like this. Then the second is the patience of learning to accept different levels of suffering. So there's the suffering, when you're obviously hurt. But there's also the suffering that takes place when happiness turns to unhappiness or neutrality. And then there's also this thing of being, how you understand it. We're like this body and mind that we've taken to be ourselves is actually created through karma and affliction. So since we've taken it to be us, we have to be patient with all the crap we go through, right? Like when we age, when we die, it's suffering. Right? Yeah, but we've grabbed it, we're holding on to it. So you have to be sort of patient, okay, that's my situation I'm in. The other one is to be really patient with trying to get out of it. Right? Like, what way out is through Dharma. And the real Dharma here is the wisdom realizing emptiness. That's not an easy thing to get your head around and then to practice, let alone just being patient. There's three parts: disregarding harm from others, voluntarily accepting hardships, and confidently facing deep truths about reality. So this is, I always remember this one. So one of the antidotes to, one of the ways you can be patient and use your patience as an antidote to anger or the harm that others do to you. They give you a thing to remain silent and still, acting like a log of wood until the hurt passes. So you know, Douglas, if you ran out to the forest and started abusing a tree, it'll just stay real still. It's not going to hurt you. It's not going to get a branch and go back like that. So same as us. Just try and be just be like that. You know, it's not easy, is it? It's not easy feeling all that hurt in there and just breathing, right? And not go rah. That's hard to do that. And so, of course, you find that like white soot, too, so beneficial to not hurt, not respond to harm with harm. It's a real bad idea. But I found this quote in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and I thought that's an easy thing to forget. So, I put it in this class. It says, so, when seeing an enemy or even a friend committing an improper action, by thinking that such things arise from conditions, I shall remain in a happy frame of mind. So, I was saying before about how when people behave badly, we actually just look at the person. And it's just saying, no, it's not the person, it's conditions. The person is conditioned. When conditions come together, the effect arises. Just think of it as being, conditions. In the First Noble Truth, it tells us that we lack control over the conditions. So when we look outside, there's all these conditions. Do we have any control over them? Yes, we don't know. You got any control over the conditions that are taking place in your body? And not much, if any. Right? But then, like, you take it down and you lost control over it, right? You made control over choosing, but once it's all the rest is out of your control again. So, you see, all these disturbing emotions, there's not one of them decides. A disturbing emotion like anger doesn't say, I'll hurt you or I'll hurt the other person. Never does that, right? So, why does it do it? It's all conditioned. So anyway, we talk about when we become Buddhists, he says, well, once you've taken refuge and say, put my hand up on a Buddhist, so, well, what do you do as a Buddhist? One answer you could give is, I follow the Buddhist teachings on cause and effect. So causes and effects, so the causes, to produce their effect, they need conditions to support them. So like anger requires conditions. In fact, everything does to exist. And it's just saying like these conditions, most of them are out of your hand. So when people behave badly, you can go, well, of course. And I'm like that too, right? But of course, it's like, no, it's not really in our hands, is it? And so, once you have to decide, notice that first of all, before deciding, well, can I get some control? And the answer is yes, you can. And this is what you do. And then they introduce you to the Dharma. But like I say, all the time, most of the times, like I said, every disturbing emotion just arises because the conditions are there. Without them, they don't arise. With them, they do. So, wow, that's a nice way of looking at, wow, everything was, conditioned. Okay, so we're over time, so I'll let that one go. But basically, so I've tried to introduce you to that, like, tonight and last week, we've looked at the practices of a person of great capacity. Last week, we looked at wishing bodhicitta. Tonight, we looked at engaging bodhicitta. We have this verse, 8 of Lama Tsongkhapa's, which we talked about. Here you're sort of saying, you take the Bodhisattva vow and then you engage in the perfections. And as I've said, each perfection has got sort of three levels. We looked a bit at the perfection of patience. I think the perfection of patience was chosen here because anger destroys the mind of enlightenment. So we have to find something that will oppose our anger. So if you have any material at all that you can come across, so excuse me, your book that you had, Have a look in there. You'll find material on the great scope there, and just have a look, read through it. Now, 19, 11, 12, that might be a lot to do. Just find what you can do. There are four other verses. You have this verse also in your book. And next, we're going to look at the view. The view I love. Let's dedicate our material. So you've been sitting here, putting energy into listening, thinking it through, trying to work out how this thing works, and then hopefully we'll try and put it into practice. So we take that energy that we've created and direct it towards our goal of attaining Buddhahood for all sentient beings. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, rise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. In the prayer for as long as his long life, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And then finally, the prayer for Rinpoche's swift return. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings with explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and is never discouraged. Incomparable, able Guru, to you I make this request.